Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to this edition of Inside Scoop Live and Internet Voices Radio. This is one of many features presented to you by Reader Views. I'm your host, Gail Campbell. Hello, and thank you for tuning in. Today, I'm chatting with Ajamu Jamal about his new book, Spiritual Shackles. But before we dive into the book, I'd like to tell you a little bit about him. Jamal grew up in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, a very difficult period for many African-American people, a period when racial slurs and violence towards innocent people just because of the color of their skin was a normal way of life for many people living during those times. Jamal's life experiences and his desire to tell the stories of all those African-American communities that were cast out by political and social structures inspired him to write his first book, Spiritual Shackles. We're going to let him tell us more about that a little later on. Jamal was born and grew up in Pasadena, California. After high school, he attended University of California at Berkeley, Cal State Los Angeles, Cal State San Bernardino, and Pasadena City College. He attained his bachelor's degree in history and his master's degree in educational administration. As an educator, he has coordinated Head Start programs, taught in elementary, middle, and high school classrooms, and has instructed courses at Cal State colleges. Jamal currently resides in Southern California with his wife, where he teaches history at a California high school. He enjoys jazz, track and field, chess, storytelling, and travel. His biography will also be featured in the 10th edition of Who's Who Among American Teachers. Jamal, welcome.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for joining us today. There's a lot about your book that is inspiring and is just truly inspirational. As we get underway here, would you tell the audience a little bit about the storyline of your novel, Spiritual Shackles?
Probably the easiest way for me to talk about it is that it is a novel, but it is really a history book disguised as a novel.
Mm-hmm.
It has all the feel of a novel, a steamy novel,
uh-huh.
But it has in it the changing of attitudes that took place, and it goes deeper into these attitudes that change, not from any type of a philosophical type of point of view, but the everyday on the street point of view of what and how people were at the time. And as these attitudes move and change, they also change with the community around them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a quick overview of the book itself, I guess.
Okay. Well, and in particular, exactly what was it that motivated you to write about this?
As I've said at a couple of my book club appearances, that I have always said to myself one day, like I guess many people, especially those in education,
mm-hmm.
I said that I'm going to write this book one day about certain things. And history has always been, there's some things are subjects that people have in school that to them that was just like rolling over. It was so easy and you loved it. And so I've always enjoyed it, and fortunately to go with that, I have a fairly good memory.
Good thing.
With the wanting history and remembering the things that took place and almost like put them in categorize them in your mind, these things here, finally, when it came to a couple of things, and I really think it was reading a couple of people I enjoyed reading, and I said it's time for, I'd really like to get to work on this project.
And may I ask really quickly how long it took you to write it?
People ask me that, and I want to try to give them as honest of answer as possible. I started on it, let's see. I always say it was about 5 years in real time,
mm-hmm.
but not in actual time, because I only wrote over the summers when I was away from the school, away
uh-huh.
from teaching and so forth. I really couldn't write when I came in from work, and so I really stopped doing it. So it would be over the course of about 5 summers, and so that would, and the holidays, I'd throw in the holidays, and I would race home and get locked up in my room and start writing on the 2 weeks we were out in the winter and the week in the spring and things like that. But I would say about five years in actual time, and maybe a year, a little over a year or two in real time.
Right.
Maybe 2 years just in real time that I was actually sitting down and writing.
Wow. Well, all right. In your book, you have created a community called Ebonyville. I love that name. Tell us the significance of it.
The name comes from when I was growing up. We used to call it Colored Town. I mean, it was the black community there in Pasadena.
Right.
And there was a newspaper in town, and he was a very, I would say, he enjoyed his sauce.
He
tended, and many people will find his character in the book in some a certain degree.
They'll recognize him, huh?
They will recognize it. There was an actual person there, and he did refer to it, and people got mad at him, and that was something I remember when I was very young. He's really speaking of this community. It was a very, in a way, it's still a unique community there. It's separated for those out of the area of Southern California. It's separated from Los Angeles. So you have Los Angeles with the large black population back in this time. And then 13 miles over the freeway, there is another black community, and it's the only one of any significant size outside of Los Angeles. And in this area, Pasadena, this is old money Pasadena, very very rich as
mm-hmm.
far as the white communities, but the black community serviced them, and that was really how you can remember a lot of this coming up. And so he gave it that term, Ebonyville, or Colored Town. Because he felt it was a bunch of maids and chauffeurs. And I remember he wrote a column kind of zinging people about that way back, and people got mad at him.
Well,
it's just one of the things that brought up the name, that name itself.
Right, okay, because there is mention that this book sort of explodes out of a dramatic images of unexplained church fires, and that it's etched deep in the faces of the players, from maids, chauffeurs, and preachers to Panthers, Muslims, and black nationalists.
Right.
Wow.
As it comes through, the storyline is laid in the early idyllic.
Oh, yeah.
Gilded, if I can use that term.
I like the term gilded
back,
better.
That they're gilded type of, that's what you saw, but at gilding there's a underneath there that you don't see.
Mm-hmm.
But it was during that time, it begins, and you get to meet people in this era, and then they really, and there's one of the central characters there, that her name is Mama Vi. And
yes, I was just going to ask you more about her.
Yeah, she's probably a step or two ahead. It's almost like leaving a rural town and stepping to the city somewhere, someone who comes to that rural town from it might be a couple of steps ahead in thought because they've just seen more.
Exactly.
And this is how she really comes over as this person who has seen a little bit more. And she really is moving the young people who live with her and with the best word we could use for it was a foster home. Because,
mm-hmm.
But anyway, they live with her. And as she raises them, she gives them insights into things that would not have normally have been a part of this particular community. Maybe in Harlem and New York or somewhere they would have been, you know, more tuned to where she was coming from. But not in Pasadena.
Right.
So she really takes them a step or two beyond this. And in doing so, this is where we get the, movement from the early part, and then all of a sudden, and it was dramatic because it seemed dramatic at the time, they meet the ideas of Malcolm X, and thrown on top of this old, almost satisfied my Ebonyville is this thunderous ideology and voice and personality of Malcolm X as it's brought to them by one of the characters.
Wow.
And this really just sort of snatches the book, it snatches the people, and as I say, in the novel, and just turns it right away. And then you meet this group that comes forward, the young people who come. Some join the Nation of Islam. Some immediately move into Dr. King's movement.
Mm-hmm.
They start their own movement. It's just a lot, an awful lot of activity, just moving, that was unlike anything else that had been seen.
And this book actually is tracking the lives of five children from their infancy through into their adulthood.
It tracks I sit and wrote this in a room by myself pretty much, so I didn't have all do's and don'ts of what goes into a novel. I guess it was about
there's something out there about do's and don'ts about how to write a novel?
People tell you that you shouldn't do this with a novel. It's going to be, you know, and I didn't know any of those rules, fortunately. So I just wrote it the way I wanted to, you know, the way it came out. And this is one of the things that happened.
Well, it sounds powerful. It sounds powerful. And I've heard it said before that the best way to write is to just sit down and let it come out. You know,
well,
don't edit yourself. Just let it come out.
Well, you know, I would be a convert to that if I hadn't said that before. But I didn't know. I had not. I have written before, and I've written when I used to do union work, and I would write the newspaper for years back. I'd write the newspaper for the Head Start part of the American Federation of Teachers.
Right.
I really, you know, that was fun to do. And the only other thing that I knew about writing is when I had to take my graduate composition, and I was fortunate to have a teacher at the university that right away had, I'd already, you know, you kind of figured it through, but she really was a very encouraging lady, and she said, you know, you really should think about writing more. And I had never, you know, I had thought about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But to have someone who makes their living correcting all of these papers when she got them, and there were, you know, that she said that my writing was some of the finest that she'd seen.
That is fabulous.
Wanted me to. So I think it was about a couple of years after that that you did it. But I did. I was reading a lot at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And read all of Toni Morrison. I did B.B. Campbell. I did all of the ones, Terry McMillan, the ones who were very popular. At the same time, I went back and read some of the authors that I always loved, like Richard Wright and Ralph Ellison. Then I picked up John G. Jackson's book, and he's mentioned prominently, and rightly so. He was a very intriguing writer and historian, and I believe that though his name may not be mentioned through the entire work, a person who is aware of him can probably feel him in far more of the book than he's mentioned.
Well, with that, and that, all of that added to create your current writing style, right?
Yes, that would be. I know when I started writing, I quit reading everything. I couldn't read anything except the creative writers I see, like Toni Morrison, and I could not pick any, nothing. I wanted it to be my work, and now all of a sudden you realize if you're reading, you don't know when that's going to bleed into what you're trying to create. And
well,
so
that's
the best
right.
thing to do was just to cut everything off. So
put it aside.
Five years I didn't read anything else. I just I worked on this particular book.
Wow.
As you said, as they said, you broke. First thing that I was immediately told was that, a first-time novelist isn't supposed to write over 250 pages. Didn't you know that?
Well, as a matter of fact, I saw in the review that the reviewer said this was, even though a 500-page book, I wanted more at the end of the 500 pages.
Well, I have heard that from quite a few of the ones who have called or commented or sent me an email that, my God, are you going to continue this in another one? And it is split into part one and part two, with part one initially trying to make the decision as to whether we would go with one or two book, and mm-hmm. I say we, I'm just a couple of my, you say look at the table of all these people around, no, it's just me and my wife and friend.
Hey.
And we're trying to decide, and it was a very close call as to what we would do, and we decided, look, just though it might go better as two, why don't we just keep it as the one, and then we'll make it part. And I said, well, we'll part it when the children, as the children are young, and the book is being carried by the parents at that time, and a sort of the tweener, I call him, between the young kids and the parents, there is a very powerful personality in a young man in there that carries it. And they carry it to the end of part one.
Okay.
And then you go into part two, and these kids that you met at the foster home, or you somewhat meet them, but you know that the book is about them. Then it goes into part two, and it just explodes into these young people who just have the energy to track and seek and look for answers and challenge and question. And this is the way. So it did come out in two parts, and it is all in one book. So you get two for one.
Great. Well, and you know, I think early on I said that it starts out with the infancy of these five people, but that's not right. It starts out in their adolescence, doesn't it?
It does start with the, yeah, it's only mentioned. They're only mentioned, but I believe it's in very, as you read it, it's extremely, this is an important part. Even though they personally, you don't meet them, you get sort of a thumbnail sketch of them, and you know it's going to be about them. And probably the big tip is that Mama Vi, early in the book, reads them a story, as the narrator of the book relates it. And the story is Isis and Osiris.
Ooh.
And Isis and Osiris, as told by, and I go in researching that story itself, and or some people say the mythology of it, but
mm-hmm.
it's a story. It's written down in many different ways. And you pick the ones I want. I believe I picked Pouchard and Herodotus when I was going through to kind of put it together. And in doing so, there are the five children who will become the demigods on Earth. And he goes through and he explains this, which if you're reading it at that time, people probably looked at it and didn't really realize that that was the skeleton of the entire novel.
Wow.
Indeed, these five kids were going to be their race. And the story itself, as I said, is laid out there in the early on in the book. And I believe the title of that chapter is Isis and Osiris.
Oh, fantastic.
And so a person could read that. And mostly, I can tell by, I remember a phone call, a person called, I know what's getting ready to happen. These five kids are going to grow up like the five kids in the story. And,
Well, and you know, of course, it's as you go through all of this and as you portray their adolescence and their adulthood, in the midst of it all, we see that there is tremendous mental and spiritual unraveling.
I would say that I knew in writing it that I would probably be challenging I would be swimming upstream against a powerful current that's always within our community, the African American community there, and that is our strong religious foundation. And so when you come in forthright and actually just bring in the characters and some are, we might, other, especially today, people might think probably of the Nation of Islam is rather radical, but it's really it's always very a conservative organization, and not only was it very conservative, it's very close to being a Christian organization in a lot of instances as to how many times early on you'd go to some of their mosque meetings and you'd hear Jesus Christ mentioned more than you did Allah. And even when later on, when Farrakhan would give his Million Man March speech, he mentioned Jesus Christ more properly than he did Allah. So it's not that one wasn't unusual. I believe that as you looked at it, the traditional religion of Africa, as explained by Mama Vai in the Yoruba faith, I think this was the one that was more shaking. And then the one that's brought in by CJ, who's not bringing it in, but he speaks of the African Orthodox Church brought in by Marcus Garvey. And their feelings about the mainstream Christian or view of Jesus. This, to some people, was sort of rattling because, it does go to the heart of some things that you've just taken for granted.
Well, and you know, my observation is that regardless of denomination or non-denomination, there's always interpretation. And so many things are done in the name of that are not really intended to be. I mean, the Muslim community, the Christian community, how do I want to say it? I'm going to call them prophets. I'm going to call Jesus a prophet. And Jesus never intended, I don't believe, for Christians to do things in the name of Christianity that defies all definition of Christianity.
Well, the term itself, the name of the book, Spiritual Shackles,
mm-hmm.
which stops some people to look at it who really, what's this about? Early on in the book, the term is really used once, and it's used by one of the early guys sitting around the ballpark there as he's talking, and he's very upset about the photo of Emmett Till in the Jet magazine, and he is trying to explain to his young son why black people didn't do anything. Why do we let them do this to us, that they murdered this boy who was his age? He's 13, the boy asking the question,
mm-hmm.
so Till was 14. And that he murdered, why didn't we do anything? And then after he moves on down to look at a couple of colored teams from Los Angeles were playing there in Riverside Park.
Mm-hmm.
And as he moves down, the two men continue to talk. And in that, he says, it really that lends itself to this. He says, you got to understand what's going on here. We're not, he sort of goes over it, and he mentions that, we've got ourselves chained to all of this religion that we got while we were in slavery. And then a few chapters later, Malcolm then uses the exact word spiritual shackles when he's talking to Stoney, one of the young boys who he's grown up. He's about 4 years older now.
Mm-hmm.
And Malcolm is talking to him, and Malcolm says, as long as you believe in something that doesn't that doesn't look like you, I want to try to get pretty close to what it was. That he
right.
Said. Then you say you're not out here fighting for freedom. You guys are trying to crawl back on the spiritual plantation. You can never. You're like a slave. You're spiritually shackled to the floor of the slave ship. And this was close to. And this here was the after writing this part of the book that the title was then put on the book, Spiritual Shackles.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it occurs to me that the whole concept of spiritual shackles transcends race and religion.
Yes, it does.
Totally. Well, moving on here, what I also want to touch on is the fact that throughout your book, you have used the themes of love, hate, horror, deceit, mystery, and humor. as you go through some horrifying episodes that these young people go through and experience, episodes that many people were going through during that era of white and black, and yet you do it in such a way as to bring about a book that some people have said they were bursting out laughing, they were just gut-wrenching laughter, tears of joy, tears of probably nostalgia, but by delving into the lives of people who were maids and chauffeurs and preachers and Panthers and Muslims and black nationalists, people who in the 50s and 60s were angry and both frightening and frightened.
Mm-hmm.
And you've woven all that into a book that is a compelling read.
Well, I want to thank you. I feel that that as I say, writing it sort of in isolation by yourself. When I finished it, and I yelled up and told my daughter, because they'd seen me writing on this thing for 5 or 6 years.
Right.
And I said, I'm finished. And they said, finished with what? And I said, I'm finished with the book. And they said, you're what? Here's this book sitting there in manuscript form in three-ring binder after I went down and finally got it printed out. Here it is sitting here. And she says, well, I said, I don't know what people are going to say. It hasn't been read by, I've had a chapter read by this and that. I definitely had the one on Miles Davis read by a good friend of mine that was really into music and made
mm-hmm.
sure I had everything correct.
Mm-hmm.
And but it hadn't been read, and so I had to send it to someone who said that, and I knew he would. He read it. And when he sent me back he just sent me a one word, and he just sent me one word back.
And the one word was?
Outstanding.
How about that?
And
oh, that's fabulous.
I almost collapsed on the floor. That you mean? And I finally called. I said, you mean it all came together? all the different storylines and all of this? He says, absolutely. He said, this is a great work.
Oh.
And so I really, that was the first time I had a chance to see if all of the characters, as you said, if they came together, if all of the humor, if all of the sadness. And I would say that even though it's during this era there in Pasadena, there were some humorous things we talked about there. But some of the more, as you say, horrible instances described in the book took place in other areas. They took place in Brazil, and they took place in Suriname, and that people really looked at. And that is the instrument there on the back of the book. It's called the breaking rack, and that was used by the Dutch.
Wow.
So that was in Suriname. And so it was, a lot of that was not really there were not a lot that was the major one, which is why it was part of the cover.
Right.
And so that was in Suriname, and that was the Dutch.
Well, they were big slave traders.
Yeah.
They had slave huts and slave establishments all over the Caribbean, for sure.
Right.
All right, Jamal, tell us the part of the audience that you're trying to target. Are we segmenting anything here?
No, I would say I looked at it initially as that who would want to read a history, even though some people say it's more of a novel, but I still say that why I decided to write it was because of the history.
Right.
If people wanted to ask me I slipped the question. Well, you better give it to me again. I was going to go off somewhere else.
No, we were talking about the target audience.
I automatically assumed that the audience was going to be those most interested in African American history and so forth, which would be an African American audience. And so that was immediately, well, I didn't think many other people would be interested, and we laughed about it. Like I said, if somebody wrote a book on Mandarin Chinese and the way the people live in northern China, who would be most interested in that? And they said, well, probably the Chinese in northern China. And I said, that's what I'm thinking. So that was initially the target audience. And
but you had to have been pleasantly surprised that it wasn't limited to just that group.
But I knew that it should go everywhere, and I knew that it should be a book that a lot of people would read my my department chair, I immediately, when it came out, gave him one, and I said, you might want to look, I said, pretend as being white. I said, pretend that you just picked up a pair of glasses. Now, out of these glasses, the paradigm of all of what you see changes to what you would see if you were looking at the world through the eyes of an African American
right. Coming
up, because that's what, more than anything else, they say you really are just, you don't back off. You just continue to give those, even though to many whites it'd be the first time they may have heard or understood why we reacted differently to certain things. After reading part of the book, or that particularly, they can understand how a people would feel differently. I know that when I mentioned, as we're moving through the latter part of the book, it really moves more rapidly, and I think I kind of planned for it to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And they speak of the trial of a person in Los Angeles who was found not guilty, and everybody gets so upset. And then they look at this crowd at Howard and other places where black people are jumping and screaming. And I relate the scene